We're glad you're joining us here at Common Thread Online. This is a recording of our community gathering, as we do each week, to think together about the spiritual journey. At the end of the lesson, we open the floor for discussion. We'd love to hear what you're thinking, too. Go to our community's Facebook page, post your thoughts. So it's just 37 days now, and our One Wake community of communities will be having our founding assembly, 3 years in the making. That'll be Tuesday evening, October 13th at 7 p.m. It's important that we all zoom in to that meeting. 40 diverse institutions, mostly churches, synagogues, and mosques, have been building relationship with one another and asking what hurts people living in Wake County and agreeing to work together on affordable housing and public schools and jobs. And on that Tuesday, 2,000 of us will gather virtually. So this week, I'm going to join several other clergy, and we're going to meet with candidates from all parties, county commissioners, school boards, all elected officials, to fill them in on what's going to happen on that Tuesday. And what will happen is we'll have a roll call, and then after that, we'll ask our candidates to make specific commitments on our three issues. That's what the research groups have been working on, what to ask for that can be actually achieved. So 2,000 people in a room, even a virtual room, that's how we get taken seriously. So we're all committing to bring a certain number of people. And we, Common Thread, have committed to bring 150 that night. And we will stand up in a virtual way, and we will report, Common Thread has 150 people here, hopefully more. Common Thread is committing $3,000 for our 2021 dues. Well, Scott's working on the dues part. We have to work on the showing up part. And we've got to register to get our 150 counted. Of the 40 institutions, we are in fourth place after registration week one, which is not bad. We have 20 of our 150 registered now. Now, if I, Rebecca, make sure that the slide is up. The UU folks and the Pleasant Grove folks that you see leading this week's weekly report, they are very nice people. I've met several of them, and yet I think the world would be a better place if next week we were in first place. So if you would, go register. The link's on our website under events and news, and it's in the live stream notes. And by the way, right now would be a good time to register while you're sitting there at your computer. Poor people. We're going to beat them next week. Okay, we're starting a new lesson, as you heard. How we broke religion and how we can fix it. There are a lot of reasons people hate religion. One of the main complaints I hear, you probably hear it too, is religious people are hypocrites. Whatever it is, they think, whatever it is that religion is doing to people, on a wholesale level, it's not making us better people. Well, this week again, a prominent religious leader leading an institution that's highly committed to the conservative religious sexual norm. Turns out he's been having a three-way with the pool boy. And what struck me this week was the absence of surprise. Oh yeah, religious hypocrites, but it's Thursday. What's new? Well, people hate religion for a lot of reasons. Hypocrisy. But also, it divides us. It tells us that some of us are holy, that's usually us, and other people are sinful, that's usually them. People hate religion because it makes us anti-other people, anti-women, anti-environment, anti-LGBTQ people, anti-science people, anti-no religion people, and especially anti-other religion people, those who think they know the story and it's not our story. Well, in this lesson, we're going to talk about a lot of ways that we've broken religion and how to fix each of them. As you imagine, I'm sure, I do believe this is a noble endeavor to rescue our broken religion, to reorganize ourselves, to help one another become better people, to create a better world, which is what religion ought to be about. The thing is, we're not alone in the endeavor. All over the planet right now, people are reimagining healthier spirituality, sifting through the wreckage that religion has left behind and tossing out what's toxic and salvaging what will help us thrive. Lots of people at work fixing what we've broken. But before we get to that, I want to start, as I often do, at a more foundational level. I want to talk about why the fixing part has lagged so far behind the breaking part. Why the fixing part has lagged so far behind the breaking part. If we're going to fix what's broken, we would do well to understand why others who've gone before us, who've tried to fix what's broken, haven't already done it. Well, I was talking to Cherie as she was leaving a couple of Sundays ago after she'd led the guided meditation, and she was as angry as I've ever seen Cherie. Now, admittedly, I've never seen Cherie angry before, but she was angry. And I asked her why, and she said she'd read this book by Marcus Borg. Now, Marcus Borg is a New Testament theologian, and he's on the progressive side of Christianity. And I don't know which book she was reading, but I know a lot about the subject, so I can guess what she was upset about. She had read about the historical process that shaped the texts that we call the Bible. I imagine in the book she was reading, Borg had explained how the Hebrew and the Christian scriptures both borrowed copiously from other religions. We were never told that. Maybe she learned how our texts were shaped by political pressures, by group infighting, fights in which the good guys did not always win. Imagine she read about the sausage-making process that got some books included in the Bibles and others left out, some books resisted, others accepted, and again, how unspiritual that process really was. If you grew up revering the scriptures, when you learn that stuff, it can make you feel dirty. Because there's a whole lot of Roman Empire in there, and there's a whole lot of using spiritual texts to consolidate political power. That's in there a lot. It's not much of an exaggeration to say that what we currently believe, we owe as much of that to Constantine, the Roman Empire in the 4th century, as we do to Jesus. Frederick Buechner, I've heard some people pronounce it Buechner, is an American minister and theologian. He's an author. And he called the Bible this. He said it's a swarming compost of poetry and propaganda, law and legalism, myth and murk, history and hysteria. So when people first find out about this stuff, it's usually so much worse than they know. The deeper they dig, the uglier it gets. So I wrote a couple chapters in this in the first book, Rethinking Our Story. And since we're not in the lobby, you can get it on Amazon. You just have to pay $4 more. We give you the wholesale price when you get it here. But here's the thing that made Cherie so angry. The author that she was reading wrote, every minister who goes to seminary learns this stuff. Every minister who goes to seminary learns this stuff. Wait, what? Every minister learns this stuff? And my ministers never told me this? In fact, told me just the opposite? Whoa. You told me that the Bible was absolutely authoritative. You told me that it was clear and direct and straight from God. You hid all this complexity, gave me none of the history. You gave me no room for my doubts, no room for my questions. You just told me the Bible says, and you gave me no latitude when I hit some dead end and I couldn't believe something anymore. You never told me, oh, well, this has a cloudy origin story. If you had, I would have had the latitude to rethink and to reimagine, permission to wonder, permission to question. But all the while, preacher man, you knew and you sold me a bill of goods. You lying hypocrite. You and your whole profession out there preaching, and it was all a grand deception. You knew and you lied to me. You learned this stuff in school, and then you spent your whole life selling me tripe. Well, like I said, she was angry. If you grew up devout, and then you find out this stuff, you might share Cherie's anger. But it might be worse than you even know. Because it's not just the Bible. There's a whole lot more that preachers learn about that don't talk about. What you were taught about God, what God is like, who God likes or doesn't like, shady origin stories, what you were taught about sin and salvation, what you were taught about heaven and hell. Preachers are learning a lot about that stuff, too, and they don't stand up and say it out loud. So here's an important question. Why not? Why are preachers such lying hypocrites? Why do they keep the goods hidden away? Well, I actually don't think that as a group, preachers are any more duplicitous than anybody else. But I do know this out of experience, The religious system puts a lot of pressure on preachers. In fact, puts a lot of pressure on all religious people to stick to the script. If you have doubts, if you have questions, religion's answer is often stick to the script. And that is a pressure that will keep us, that has kept us, from fixing the religion that we have broken. Two of the three churches that I grew up in encouraged me not to go to seminary. A lot of good kids, they told me, a lot of good kids, devout kids, they head off to seminary only to lose their faith. So don't do it, Doug. The subtext was, go to seminary and you're going to learn stuff that doesn't fit in the way we do religion. And if you do that, you're not going to be one of us anymore. And when we see that process, we're going to call it you losing your faith. And that is what happened to me, but I would not call it losing my faith. But what you, for the people who told me that to think that way, they also had to think this. They had to think, we've got a thing here. We actually have God's thing here. God told us about it, mostly in the Bible. And listen, kid, you better not go learn other stuff, because that other stuff out there, it will contradict our stuff. And our stuff comes from God. Their stuff might make sense, but it goes against God. You go down that road, who knows? Burning hell has to be on the table. That's one of the main things that keeps us from fixing the parts of religion that we've broken. The fear that religion evokes in people, that's what keeps religion self-contained. We can't break out of a box that we're in and rethink the box that we're in and reimagine the box we're in, because once a religious community has some shared belief, sometimes it's not even a religious or spiritual belief. Sometimes it will just be a social norm that people in this religious group share. Religious fear will keep us from deviating from the script. Under the surface of almost anything that religion says is the belief that what we say is anchored and permanent. So if that's the case, who knows what God might do if we deviate? But for sure we know what the group will do. The group will throw us out. And so the fear of deviating from the script gets baked right into our religious systems. And it's a wild thing, this religious fear. I often talk to people who've totally given up on religion, fully embraced their new non-religious life. But as happens, when we throw out the bathwater, oftentimes we throw out the baby too. And so along the way, their pain will show up and something's going sideways and not working for them. And thinking that I might be a different kind of preacher guy, okay, let's give religion one more chance and we'll talk. And maybe as we do, I will suggest rethinking some religious belief that might be at the core causing their trouble. Now remember, already gave up on religion, full in on the non-religious life, sometimes sex and drugs and rock and roll, sometimes fully abandoning religious restraint. And then I suggest something that we might reimagine about a religious belief. And oh my God, you can't do that. It would be laughable how irrational religious fear is if it wasn't so damaging. Religious fear sits down there like a virus, just waiting to come up and resurface. The religion itself, we might have totally abandoned it, but the fear that it instilled, it's still in there. And that, I think, is why preachers betray us. That, I think, is why the religious environments get so rigid and so fixed. It's also why we can't fix what's broken. I remember several years ago, George, who used to lead our music. If you're new, you don't know him, but those of you who remember him, he told me about some study that he'd read. I didn't have time to track him down and find it. But he told me that 2 out of every 3 ministers surveyed said that if they stood up and said what they thought was true, they'd be fired from their jobs. Religious fear gets into the whole system, and it affects everything. Our most basic instincts about what we should do and what we should be in order to be religious, it gets in there, and fear gets stuck in with it all. And fixing anything that's broken is simply not in the mix, not part of the plan. So before we can fix the parts of religion that we've broken, we have to fix the fear that keeps us from being able to fix the parts of religion that we've broken. I was really proud of that sentence after I wrote it. Anyway, so how do we do that? How do we fix the fear that is behind the parts of religions that we've broken? Well, as is often the case, we start at the beginning. We strip things down to bedrock principles. And here are a couple bedrock principles: humility and goodness. Humility and goodness. On our website, we used to have a What We Believe page. We did it mostly for shock value because the stuff that we put on that page was not the stuff that good churches ought to have on their page. And the first thing we said on that page is, we believe in paradox and we believe in humility. That's not where you're supposed to start. You're supposed to start with, we believe the God, the Father, the maker of heaven and earth. That's what you're supposed to do. But what we're getting at is that the divine is too big a reality to ever say, hey, God is like this or God is like that. Worse, more complicating is the fact that we've discovered over time that truths often travel in paradoxical tandem. Justice and mercy, human and divine, sinner and saint. We discovered that spirituality is trying to describe glimpses of experience that are too big to be contained in any religious doctrines. Consequently, we said, humility is a pretty good idea. It doesn't serve us well to get too confident in our list of pet doctrines. We would do better if we cultivate hearts that are able to seek an ever-deepening experience of that deeper reality that we call divine. We don't know what we're saying when we say those words, but we know it's like a finger pointing in a direction, pointing us to deeper life or inner light or deeper love. So humility is a pretty good starting place for overcoming that religious fear that keeps us from fixing what we've broken. Humility. Religion works in spiritual territory, territory that doesn't really lend itself to the scientific method. Consequently, religion isn't after confidence. Religion isn't after a proven hypothesis. Religion isn't after certitude. That's not what we're going after. We've got no business saying to ourselves, or especially not saying to others, hey, we double-blind studied this thing, and now we've got it all figured out. Let us tell you how God is and how God does and what God likes and what God doesn't like. We do it. We do it all the time. We tell ourselves about mysteries that can only be glimpsed at the very edge of human awareness. We tell ourselves, oh, that's like this, and it's not like that. It works this way, and it doesn't work that way. We do it, but we shouldn't, because that's not the point of religion. That's not what religion's after. The point is to organize ourselves into authentic communities so we can help one another better experience those glimpses. The glimpses that inspire us to hope and inspire us to virtue and call us forward into goodness. We use all kinds of terms like whispers of the divine voice that pull us toward deeper compassion and kindness, fearlessness, valor, that pull us toward the peace that passes understanding. And that quest for experience, it happens best in the posture of humility. Or to say it conversely, it happens worse in the atmosphere of confidence and certitude. We cannot figure out and define with clarity the divine reality. We just cannot. But just because we can't figure it out and pin it down with precision, that doesn't mean that we can't experience the pull of divine gravity. It doesn't mean that we can't walk in the light of divine illumination. It doesn't mean that we can't love with the depth of divine heart. So humility, it turns out, is an antidote to the toxin of religious fear. When we can't figure it all out, confidence in our doctrines stops being the point. And then the point can become experience. Any doctrine that you learned in church never was big enough to chart your spiritual journey. As long as we make doctrine our organizing principle, we will be afraid. We will be dominated by religious fear. So, humility. Humility, and second, goodness. Again, no one of us has any idea what the divine is. When we say the words God or divine, they're just words that we use to point us toward an elusive reality that we can't contain, but we can experience. We just can't figure out spiritual stuff the way we figure out scientific stuff. But the glimpses that we do have, these spiritual glimpses, these divine moment glimpses, they are not nothing. What we glimpse, history tells us, our own experience tells us, is shot through with goodness. A good indicator that we've had a spiritual experience is how deeply we feel, sense, understand, touch the goodness of all that is. It's a little bit of a mantra in our community. We say it all the time. God is good, we are safe. God is good, we are safe. Now, we don't know what the word God means, but we have a deep sense that love is bigger than hate. We have a deep sense that joy and peace are bigger than fear and anxiety. We have a sense that there is a peace that passes understanding. There is kindness and compassion that heals us and heals the world around us. In that book I wrote, Rethinking Our Story, I told a story about a sermon I heard when I was a kid. The minister was telling a story about a job that he'd assigned to his kids out in the backyard, and they were getting it terribly wrong, making a huge mess of the yard. And looking out the window, he saw them huffing and puffing away, doing their best, but really screwing it up. So what to do, he asked. Scold them for getting it wrong or affirm them for working so hard? And then he said, well, what I did, of course, I went outside, thanked them for their hard work, and then I spent the afternoon working alongside them, doing the job properly. Well, of course, that's what goodness does. But that's not the God we feel at a very visceral gut level. Somehow, we've taken the uncontainable divine and we've shoehorned that uncontainable reality into a punitive, hard being. Parental in shape. Consequently, if we get our religion wrong, there will be hell to pay. And those instincts, they're just in there. Even though the testimony of those who've gone before us return again and again and again to divine goodness, we still fear punishment. But religion need not organize around fear. We need not keep that insidious inner fear that we'll get it wrong, that we'll suffer if we do get it wrong. Religion could be a deep embrace of light and life and goodness. So much grace, well, then we just can doubt. Why wouldn't we? So much grace that we just can ask questions and we can wonder and we can tinker. When the divine is goodness, when we run into a religious truth that isn't true enough, why not tinker with it? Why not test drive some different truth? A lot of folks in our Christian tradition don't know, but that freedom, it is our tradition. Fearless abandon, the ability to question and wonder, it is our tradition. Among some other things, really wonderful things, one thing that goodness affords us is the freedom to fix our broken religion. We do not have to be constrained by the fear of somehow getting it wrong. Okay, that's where we start today. Our tradition has granted us a robust permission, not known to many of us, permission to fix a religion that has been badly broken. Now, I wrote a whole book to help you understand the foundation of what I just said, to give you the historical. If you're interested in the biblical foundation, the scriptural understanding, how we've done that, there's a whole book on that. But when things are broken, here's the bottom line. We are allowed to fix them. Ours is the freedom to rebuild a religion so that, once again, it can help us become better people, and it can help us make a better world. So, that's the introductory week. Let's figure out how we broke religion, and let's figure out, starting next week, how we can fix it. And so, Interdivine, may we be better people building a better world, and may we reconstruct religion together in a way that will help us get there. Amen. Well, if you would, please prepare your tithes and offerings. And as you're doing that, remember, community is a great place to invest. If you get to keep your job during this pandemic, there is a great return on investment on all of our time and energy and love and the dollars that it takes to be financially healthy that we invest in community. And I use that term investment because there is a return on investment. What happens in us and what happens to us in the context that we create together of community is deeply enriching. I might say uniquely enriching. But hey, you know, you can donate on the button on our website, and please do. And while you're doing that, okay, Gene, what are folks thinking? What's stirring up in people's hearts?
So Cherie responded to you and mm-hmm. said, Doug, I'm even more upset hearing people told you not to go to seminary because you would be told things that would change your beliefs. Holy crap.
If she was pissed before, man, now she's really pissed. What else?
Let's see.
Hold on, before you go on. So it's easy to say stupid people doing stupid things. But you got to understand, this is why I wrote the book, is to say, let's be gentle on religious folk. Here's something that I'm not going to say much, so let me say it up in front. I've said it in a lot of different contexts, but I won't say this much in this lesson on fixing the religion that we broke. Religion is, by definition, a conservative institution in the sense that it conserves the truths of the past. It preserves and conserves the practices of the past. And when all around is tumult, religion holds on to this like a ballast in the ship during a time of tossing winds. And that's an important, important role that religion plays. And so consequently, as hard as it is to say, in those times, and we are living in one of them, in which huge upheaval is required, religion is sometimes the last one to the table because our instincts can betray us. The instincts that serve us so well in most generations, in the generations like the Reformation or in the generations like the time of Jesus, the resistance that we mount to that kind of change has been awful. Most of the time, that instinct serves us very, very well. We hold on to those things from the past. But sometimes, now's one of them, we got to let those things go, reimagine, rethink, reconsider. So here's what those people were doing. They were saying, Doug, we want to hold on to the truths that we've figured out and that worked, and they really did work, that worked so well for us. We got to hold on to those things. So don't go off there and, you know, get this highfalutin craziness going. You know, you got to hold on to what's really bedrock truth. So in their defense, they were doing one of the things that religion does. They were just doing it at the wrong time, doing it in a generation that was actually working against well-being. Okay, sorry, keep going.
So Michelle Carter says, how do we not become self-righteous in our humility? How do we not become the monster we're fighting?
Hey, you would be interested to know that these Wednesday nights, we're going to have four core contemplative practices. You would be interested to know that we're going to try and figure out during those 4 weeks how to help one another through the rest of the time be faithful to our meditative practice. Because if you want to know the answer to Michelle's question, it's this: meditate. If you want to not fall prey to self-righteousness, if you want to not fall, here's what self-righteousness it is. It's an internal defense of the ego self that is not big enough to contain our humanity. But boy, do we fight like hell to keep it. And we hold on to that ego self and we do this. And here's what meditation helps us do. Here's what examine helps us do. Here's what the welcome prayer does. Here's what loving kindness meditation does. It helps us deconstruct that false ego version of self and tap into the inner divine version of self. And so here's the how-to for Michelle's question. You meditate. That's how you do it. You meditate. By the way, did I mention Wednesday night? What else?
So Dallin Ford says, wow, an elusive reality we can't contain, but we can experience.
Ah, I'm glad that. I remember when I first coined that phrase, it was probably 15 years ago. I thought, man, that's enough to organize one's life around. So I'm glad it meant something to you, Dallin.
Right, and you know, believing without seeing or understanding, kind of the point, right? And then there's an old Latin quote that I remember from high school, 4 years of high school Latin, and it was the quote is "Credendo vides," which basically translated means "by believing one sees." It always kind of rings true to me, and that point, you know, your phrase is that.
Yeah. Yeah. So we get ourselves out there in the context in which people do have these experiences, these glimpses, these whispers. And then those glimpses, those whispers, they become deeply transformative to us. What I'm trying to say today is holding rigidly to our doctrines will actually keep us from being in the environment in which we have those glimpses, when we hear those whispers.
So Angela Sicoli says, I'm starting to realize some of my friends who are the most anti-church are building functional equivalents to church, podcasts, self-help books, therapy, spiritual friendships. They're doing so much of the work we are doing here just with a different voice and technique.
Yeah. So I'm fighting for religion, giving my whole life to that. I think it's important. I think a healthy religion at the bedrock of a society is essential. I think these times in which religion crashes and burns are always just the precursor to the time when we rebuild in a healthy way. We lose our way so we can find it again. That being said, somebody came to Jesus and said, hey, these guys down the street are doing it wrong. They're doing it differently than we are. And Jesus said, well, hey, if they're after the same things we're after, leave them alone. They're doing a great thing. What's her name? Diana Butler Bass. Here's a good book if you haven't read it. It's called Christianity After Religion, I think is what it's called. She talks about these times of great awakening, these times in which we come back to a healthy version of religion, which we lose our way and find our way again. And she said, yeah, we're in the middle of one of those right now. And like the Pharisees before, most church folk don't recognize that it's happening. We are in the middle of a great spiritual awakening, and church folks are missing it because we got a set of doctrines right here. And this doesn't look like our doctrines right here. And the doctrines were never big enough to contain the thing anyway. And so here's this thing going on around us, and we're missing it. So tell Angie, yes, you're right. And tell all your friends you're right. And tell them if they'd like a community to do that with, come do it with us. What else? That's right. It's all right, one more. Go ahead. Is it a good one? If it's a dumb one, forget it.
So, all right. So Sue Kemple says, none other than St. Thomas of Aquinas, the author of the Summa Theologica, with all its truth, had a near-death experience a few months before his actual death.
Uh-huh.
When he woke from it, he said to those attending him, all I have written is so much straw. And he never said another word till the day he died.
Ah, good for Thomas Aquinas. I didn't know that. All right, if you would, put your hand on your heart. Let's remember as we go that we are, every one of us, carriers of the indwelling divine. Love and joy and peace and patience and kindness and goodness, they're in us, carriers of the divine in us. And if you would extend your other hand to our city, then let's look for opportunities to share what's in us with the people that we live with, work with, go to school with, looking for opportunities to repair and heal our worlds. Amen. God bless you. We're dismissed. Love one another as you go. And hey, head over to the Zoom and check in on What Are You Still Thinking? And see you next week. If these recordings help you move forward on your spiritual journey, we hope you'll take an ownership stake in the community and support the health and well-being of the community. You can go to our website, commonthreadchurch.org, The donate button is at the top of the page for your computer's browser, at the bottom of the page for your phones.